Steve, can I ask you a question?
Of course you can.
On a scale from 1 to 10, how good does it feel after a haircut?
Oh, it's a 10. I love having a haircut. Looks like you just got a haircut, huh?
I figured it was a topical conversation to start the podcast off with, because I'm on top of the world because I just got a haircut.
Yeah, I know. It feels great, doesn't it? There's nothing like it.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know. It's like driving a new car, regardless of what the car is, for the first time. Like when you buy your new car and you're driving around your Chevy or whatever it is, and you're like, everyone's looking at me. And I was doing the same thing as I was white. I'm like, everyone's noticing my fresh haircut.
Look at me. You have that little extra hop in your step. I've noticed the same thing. You know, people don't wear hats anymore, other than like baseball caps or snapback caps, those kind of things. But like a hat, you know, like they used to wear, like a fedora or something like that. But once in a while, you see somebody wearing a hat, and you can tell that hat, they're just walking differently with that hat. I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, you're feeling different with that hat on, aren't you?
Because there's a confidence about
there
it.
There is.
Especially nowadays, like you say, because, I mean, not many people wear hats, but yeah, I mean, and what are the hats with the little sloping front? They usually have a button.
Oh, the older beret? Is it a beret?
It's kind of like a beret. It's a beret put
forward instead of on the side. Yeah.
I think everybody knows which hat I'm talking about.
Yeah,
that's one
I don't
of my
know the
favorite
names
hats.
Of hats.
Or a cowboy. We should start wearing cowboy hats.
Yeah. There's a bit that George Carlin used to do about hats and religions, and how all religions have hats. And they're like obsessed with the various hats and how to wear them and where to wear them and when to take them off and all of this stuff. It's kind of crazy. It's like when they play the national anthem, they always say, "And please remove your hats." Why?
I've been to a Catholic church for some coming of age children ceremonies of various sorts, and there was one very important one, and they had a special bishop or whatever leader in town, and you could tell because he had the largest hat out of all of the other ones, and it almost looked like a chessboard. Like seeing the kind of stage and for like whatever the
chair in front,
right? Because there was the guy in the middle with the biggest hat.
He was probably the bishop, and he can only walk diagonally.
He actually could. It was very strange. And then there was some that could only move forward two spots, and then they had to go diagonal one. I guess they were the
Now that we've lost all of our religious listeners.
Yes, I'm sorry. There we go, 20% drop in listenership.
Hey, I got mail from one of our listeners. Actual snail mail.
What?
So that was kind of cool. Yeah, he's actually somebody who's been watching my YouTube channel for a long, long time, and he sent me a book because he knew I was talking about how I'm trying to read a book every month, and so he had recently written a book, and he self-published it, and he said, "Here, I thought you might want to read this," and so I thought that was really cool.
Oh, that's fantastic. What's his name?
Dave Rutan. Interesting thing about Dave Rutan is that he speaks Esperanto.
I'm sorry?
So Esperanto is an invented language. It was invented, I think, in the 60s as a way of trying to make this universal language and to simplify language. And today, there's still a number of people who speak it fluently. It's the second most fluent made-up language. The first is Klingon.
Yes, and
people actually speak Klingon.
Dictionaries, I'm sure it's a course at some college somewhere.
Little known fact about Esperanto is that there was one movie made completely in Esperanto, and it starred William Shatner. I don't remember the name of it.
So William Shatner knows... he knows two of the most made-up languages.
Well, he was involved with them and probably spoke them phonetically, I suppose. Original Star Trek, though, they never really spoke Klingon, I don't think. Maybe not.
No, they always mostly spoke English, and I think they had some gibberish, which they kind of like didn't pay attention to. But I mean, that like set the stage for like really like people paying attention. I would submit that Star Trek was like the first show that people really started paying attention to that type, like those types of like
the
universe
lore.
Details and the lore and the whatnot. And now you literally have people speaking Klingon to one another. Do you know any of the words? Do you know any words?
In Klingon? No, it all sounds like bok, bok, gok.
Yeah,
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you just ordered a milkshake.
A blood milkshake.
A blood milkshake. One of the other reasons why I'm feeling really positive right now, and I've mentioned this, I know, over the past few podcasts, is because I'm doing a bunch of decluttering. However, I wanted to ask you, and hey, maybe if I put it out there, someone will send me something in the mail concerning this. But I'm stuck with, well, actually, don't send something in the mail because I'm trying to get rid of stuff. I'm stuck on I'm stuck on sentimental clutter. I've worked through all of the easy stuff to get rid of, and I'm now at the last 10%, but the last 10% is really tough because this is where really differences are made. And just to give full context, I'm trying to clear out a unfinished storage room to be able to create as much finished space as possible to end up having as little unfinished storage space needs in our house. Do you have an unfinished storage space in your house?
I don't explain that to me. What do you mean an unfinished storage place? You mean the walls aren't finished and stuff? It's like a rough space.
Exactly. And you know what? Oh. It might be a basement thing. It might be a Canadian basement thing, but yes, you know, quite often you have basements and sometimes they are quote unquote finished, drywalled, insulated and whatnot. Or sometimes they'll just like leave the room pretty much like whatever, just put the 2x4s and whatnot. And you use that for your storage.
Oh, right.
Anyways, so we're trying to renovate as much usable space in the house. And this really represents like it's pure storage. Like there's no other reason why you have this. There's no other reason why it's nowhere else in the house. All of the seasonal stuff even has it their place. But now you're dealing with the stuff that you are only dragging around because you have to drag it around. So I've collected a couple things. I wanted to ask what your take on like where I should be with it and if you can
keep it or ditch it.
Yeah, let's play keep it or ditch it. And I also want to find out if I'm just like out to lunch with having difficulty with some of these things or like I'm looking for some. Okay, you ready? So the first one's kind of easy.
I'm going to give you full closure on this stuff.
There you go.
I'm pretty aggressive with getting rid of clutter.
So it's stuff like the very first letterhead that I created for Clean My Space. And
hold that up a little closer.
Oh, there you go.
Hold that letterhead up so we can see.
This is so exciting for people who are just listening.
So, oh wow! It's like all these. Did you design that?
I did. That's how clean My Space started. Actually, we started as a cleaning company specifically for condo living. So the tagline was
keeping the high-rise
for
buildings.
Condo living. Yes, and we just focused on Toronto and whatnot. So we have stuff like that, and we also have things like being written up in the newspaper or like newspaper. Mm. Clippings, or our first, ad that we designed to put in a magazine and stuff like that. So it seems like I should hang on to this stuff. However, there's actually no real function to any of it. I should just be able to take a picture of it and move on. I literally make videos which compel people or tell people to do that, but I'm having issues. Do you keep old stuff like that around?
Some. And I agree. I think we all struggle with those kind of things because for whatever reason, they hold a little bit of meaning. I would have a photograph back when I was a photographer and I would have a photo published in some magazine. And for whatever reason, I always wanted to get multiple copies of that magazine.
Just in case one broke down.
I'm going to give them to people so they can see my work, you know, like they care. So it's just, you have to throw this away eventually at some point. But so I would eliminate some of those and I would keep one copy of everything. And so then it got to the point of, does it hold meaning to me? And it does in a way. And I think ultimately it comes down to how much space is that stuff taking up? And if it's just a little bit of things like the newspaper and the letterhead, I would certainly keep that. I mean, how much, it's not going to take, if you can put it in a box, in a small box. I think the problem comes with things like children's artwork, when they're just like, they are just artistic machines cranking out stuff.
Let's get into that.
Oh no.
Because that's tough.
This
one
is the harder one.
Only brought a representation, and again, it doesn't matter because I understand this is a podcast, but it ranges from everything from just like earlier pieces where she just spread color.
Oh, that was her blue period.
Yeah.
A little bit of green.
She started kind of delving into green, but anything else was and then stuff which was like when she literally got to the point where she could start creating. So like the earliest kind of like stages of things and things being like, wow, look at what you've done. I agree with maybe keeping a couple of these, but you end up getting to the point where it's like, I'm saving
it's
everything. And again, that box fills up pretty quickly. So I figure I've always kind of used the idea of a memory box, but my issue is now I have four memory boxes because they've just kind of kept growing and I've got whatever. So now I want to bring it down to one memory box, but some of the stuff needs to go. So we're going to say that kids' art is probably pretty safe to move on from.
Well, it depends. I mean, you want to keep some of it, you know, but then at some point you're going to have to you're going to have to rate the artwork. You're going to have to be like, okay, I have four pieces here. This was all made during the blue period. Which of these holds more value to me as a memory? Because I guarantee you, when Riley gets older, she ain't going to remember and she isn't really going to care, because I know Wyatt has stuff that we saved onto it. And once in a while I'll look at it, run across and be, oh, look at this. And he'd be like, okay, whatever. It does, so it's only only for us. But here's the funny thing. We did just this last Christmas. We're going through all of our boxes of Christmas crap. And, you know, you pull them out once a year. And I always think I'm going to organize the Christmas boxes. And every year I get them out. And I'm like,
maybe next year.
And so it's gone for a year. But anyways, we found this tube. It was like a toilet paper tube. Cardboard tube that was decorated with cotton, a beard, and it was a little Santa Claus and with construction paper around it. And Wyatt probably made that in kindergarten, and we stuck that on top of the tree. I thought it was really funny. It was a tree topper. And so I mean, that's the kind of thing. I think it's like a legacy piece now. We sort of have to. It was crap. I mean, the whole thing is all falling apart. He had no artistic ability when he was little, and when he painted, everything was just this one color of gray because he took all of the colors and just mashed them all together. But we did at one point. I remember going through sort of a purge of his artwork, and it was hard. I mean, now years later, I don't miss. That artwork, and we still have representations of it. So I think it's good to keep some of it. I'm not one of these people that says, you know, get rid of all of that stuff. And you know, taking pictures is good for some things, but it's not the same. It's not the same as holding that construction paper with the macaroni art falling off of the paper and stuff.
It's true. I remember in the early days of the internet when there was websites just specifically about strange and weird topics. And I know we've talked about this in the podcast before, but there was one that was called, like ratemykidsshittyartwork.com or something along those lines. And people would just submit their kids' bad drawings. And this person had a wonderful sense of humor and had the ability just to be like, give like a wonderful caption and make fun of kids' artwork. And it was a wonderful time on the internet. Let's move into to maybe stuff which isn't as easy as those things.
Okay.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
The key to my first car.
For me, that would be something I would ditch. A key holds no sentimental value. I do have an emblem on my Dodge Charger. That's the only thing I have left of it. It's just Charger in script letters. It's like one of those chrome things. That's the only thing I have of that. But keys, no.
No. And that's how I felt too. I saw it and I was like, hey, that's the key to, and then I was like, that's a useless key. And like, it didn't do what I thought it would do. Does that make sense? Like it doesn't so I'm happy to kind of move on from that. All right. Here's a tough one. My grade 3 notebook, like journal. And it was at a time where you had to do a certain amount of lines. So I would start halfway down the page. And then eventually the teacher started getting frustrated and being like, you need to start over here, Chad. This is where
there's arrows pointing to the margin. Like your margins are too wide.
Not good enough.
You need to tab over a little. And nice handwriting there.
Yeah, no. Thursday, December 12th, 1985. Yesterday, I was making out my Christmas list. And at the same time, I was watching Annie and the Christmas lights were on. That was a stellar day. I'm probably going to move on from that.
I would keep that.
I'm probably going to keep that. I mean, that's mine. So I remember getting that from my mom. So yes, no, I definitely will, because I need to I need to know this. Here, how about this? This is an autograph, which at the time was amazing. But now I really don't much care about Dennis Leary. So the question is, do I still need a... I mean, it's a funny one. It's when I was doing stand-up comedy, and I randomly, I don't know, whatever, there was just something, and I was talking to him, and he was like, oh, I'm still okay. And so he wrote, and he put, Chad from a real comedian, Dennis Leary. And I think that's kind of funny, but like, it's in a frame. I don't know. That seems excessive.
I don't know. That's a tough one.
Do you have autographs? Do you keep autographs?
The only autograph that I say we have, because really it was Wyatt, was James Hetfield, because we were at a burger place here in Moran, and he was sitting there eating burgers, and Wyatt and I were eating, and this was a funny story, because we're sitting there eating lunch, and this is many years ago, and I have my back turned to the rest of the tables, and Wyatt is sitting on the other side of the table, and he said, wow, there's a guy behind you that looks just like James Hetfield. And this is when Wyatt was really into playing guitar. You know, he was probably 12. And I look over, I'm like, oh yeah, it does kind of look like him. You know, it's one of those things.
Yeah.
And then I heard him talk, and that voice, you know, that deep voice, I'm like, wow, that sounds like, and then we could see his neck, and he's got the tattoos, and Wyatt goes, I know those tattoos, that's James Hetfield. And he's fairly near us. So he was with this other guy, and we had this little conversation between Wyatt and me, like, I want to go up and talk to him, but I don't, because I don't want to be that guy who's interrupting his meal and you know, this whole thing. And is it, but then I convinced myself that if I don't, I will probably regret it. You know, this is the one chance I had to talk to James Hetfield. People would love to talk to James Hetfield. And so I used Wyatt as kind of a ruse. So I walked over and I said, my son is sitting. At first, I said, I just got to ask, you're James Hetfield, right? And he's like, yes, I am, you know, voice. And I expected him to go, yes, I am. But, you know,
pull out a guitar from nowhere.
I know. I said, that's my son over there. He's 12. I said, he is so into playing guitar and he loves your music. Would it be all right if he come over and say hi? Oh my God, James Hetfield was the nicest guy. He came over and talked to Wyatt for probably 10 minutes about guitars and just, oh man, I love it. This is so cool. You should just keep doing it. And he was really encouraging. So I went up and got a menu from the place, a little takeout menu, and I had him sign that. So that's my James Hetfield autograph story. And I made a frame for it, a special guitar frame that I actually shot a video of that years ago.
So I think you proved a great justification for keeping an autograph like that. And I think my Dennis Leary autograph is perfect. I mean, I'll get rid of the frame. I'll maybe keep.
You got a story behind it, though.
Slide it in the box because it'll take up less space. But I'm gonna call it there.
Yeah, I could sell it on eBay for maybe $3 or $4.
So let's talk about that for a minute. Because some of the stuff I have is stuff like comics and like old when we used to have money, and I used to like collecting money anyway. So I have some like older stuff, but. I remember like collectible stuff, which does have value associated with it. But I remember a long time ago when I was first introduced to eBay, I got ripped off a bunch of times. So I became really hesitant selling things online. Do you hold on to things because they have, quote unquote, a certain value? So therefore, I'm not going to get rid of it. And do you have issues with actually going through and parting with those things and instead of making it always an excuse?
Yeah, I stopped doing the excuse playing that game a long time ago when I found out that really the stuff you think you have has value probably doesn't have a lot. And it's probably for me, because I used to be one of these people who would sell stuff that, well, I've had it a while. It's kind of rare. I had like this really antique telephone. I thought that was really cool. And by the time of all the hassle and everything, it just wasn't worth dealing with eBay. And that was, I haven't used eBay probably since 2004 or 2005. I mean, it's been a long time, probably two decades since I was actively using eBay.
I mean, I guess I should just call like a
dealer or something like that. Just be like, listen, I have everything for sale. Someone can just give me a reasonable offer and like whatever, because yeah. I hate the thought of like a million ads and then you have to email back and forth and it's just not even worth it.
And is it, is it worth your time?
I'm pretty confident to your first point, I'm affixing some of the sentimental value in the monetary value, which I think it has. Mm. Like, it's important for me. I think it's cool, but like, yeah, no one's really going to pay $25 for my Star Wars comic from, you know, like, I think it's worth a while because it's an old Star Wars comic. But the reality is there's lots of, right.
This is why my stepmom, well, I was talking to you last year. I was trying to clean out their place, and she's kind of a hoarder. And this is one of the things she always says about stuff. She'll have something she gets at an antique sale, and then she keeps it because it's worth something. Mm-hmm. You know, if anything that's just old is just automatically worth something, that's her justification for keeping everything. I'm like, well, it's not worth anything unless you sell it and have a buyer for it. It's worth zero.
I have made up the fact that I like collecting old electronics, like my old cell phones. This is, for those who can't see, it's a BlackBerry with the actual keypad and the little thing. And I have all of these. I have all of my flip phones. I've kept all of my, and it's wonderful. It's a trip down memory lane. And one day, I guess I think that like a museum will approach me and be like, thank you for keeping all of your phones.
You,
we're going
you
to
kept
set up
the
a display.
One BlackBerry. Yeah,
right, exactly. Or like, you know, it's so interesting to see your progression, or like I'm going to have friends over and be like, hey guys, are you all interested in seeing my old phones? And I think,
look at my iPod. Yeah.
So I know, because I do Clean My Space videos, that you can go to places like Best Buy and just literally drop off, like recycle your old electronics.
E-waste. Yeah,
e-waste
disposal.
So that one's pretty easy.
You keep it because everybody's going to be throwing it away. You're going to be the last one left.
Ooh.
And then it's going to be worth something.
And that's, again, that mindset which locks you into hanging on to this stuff. Here's one that might appeal to any music lovers. CDs. I know. However, you know, Fiona Apple, Stan Getz, Radiohead, White Zombie. What a great album cover. And then back in the day, you used to have like, oh, this is a limited edition from Europe CD and da 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 da. But however, today, like, you can't even give these to a cash converters. You can't sell CD. Like, who wants a CD? Who's going to play anything? Mm. So, like, is this literal just waste?
No, you keep them until they're retro. No, I did get rid of all of mine, but we donated them. Places like, I think Goodwill, you know, Salvation Army, they actually sell them in their stores still. They actually sell VHS tapes and things, which is kind of funny because now there's sort of this nostalgic collectors of VHS tape because they want to see the crappy quality is like enhances the quality, especially on old like cult movies and things. So, but I got rid of my CDs because I could not justify keeping those. There's no sentimental value for me to those. I couldn't justify keeping them when I can just pull up Spotify and listen to any song I want. And the same with all of my DVDs. I used to keep DVD movies collected them. I had hundreds of them. And I got rid of them. I don't even have a player anymore.
What's your take on pictures? This is me. First day of kindergarten.
You posted it on Instagram, didn't you? Or you posted something recently on Instagram.
I think that's part of the reason why I bring this picture up is because it's like, yeah, I literally now have that memory in the cloud. And this is a physical representation.
Hair.
I know, right? Those were the days. It was just a bowl. It was a bowl, and that's what you got.
You look really happy there.
I was so I had no idea what I was in for.
You're like, look at these pants.
School sounded so cool, and I was like, I'm ready for school. And I had a little Charlie Brown book, and then they're like, oh no, wait, you need to learn and sit down and stop moving around, Chad. I don't think pictures are very difficult, so I'm going to move on from pictures. How about things like airplane tickets or concert tickets or stuff like, oh, concert tickets, Steve. You like your concerts. You
yeah,
your concert
I kept my
tickets.
Concert tickets and then I don't, at some point I got rid of them. But yeah, I kind of missed, we were talking about that recently. They don't, you know, because you don't get tickets anymore. It's all on your phone. And it was kind of cool to keep those. I used to, when I was, you know, in my teens and early 20s, I had them you know, thumbtacked to my wall, like all the concerts. It was like the badges of honor that I'd seen all of these. There's my AC/DC, there's my Van Halen ticket. But no, somewhere along the line, I got rid of it. But again, those don't take up much space. I mean,
true, right. And that's what I mean, the same is kind of with some pictures and whatnot. It's like little pieces of paper. And again, I have a big box, so I'll pick
maybe
the
solution is to just keep one box. Just don't let anything go beyond that box.
That's it. As soon as you need more space, then you have to go through and address what's in the box and move on from some stuff. So you always have the same stuff. So the last thing I'll talk about is the gold play button. I'm not going to get rid of the gold button. However, it came with a box. Yeah. Which is a one-of-a-kind box. Clearly, this is the only box that is made for delivering play
dark
buttons.
Gray,
The dark gray box, and it says YouTube on the front, so I saved that. I saved the letter from Susan Wojcicki.
Yeah. It's from Susan, yeah.
So this is a collector's item now.
It says something like, you've done something that... I forget what they say, but I still have mine.
You're bigger than Vancouver. You're bigger than Venice.
Oh,
even bigger than Las Vegas. Are all of them different, or is it just a stock?
Oh, man, I'm going to have to find mine and see. It's very similar. You're bigger than this, that, and this.
Because
it's interesting she started with Vancouver, though.
Well, I'm Canadian and whatnot.
So, yeah.
Venice and then Las Vegas. 1 million subscribers. Maybe you imagined that day for a long time, or maybe you never thought you'd grow so big. Either way, not much can match the satisfaction of finding out that your creativity, that your ideas, that your voice speaks to 1 million people across the globe. We know that being able to touch the lives of so many people is reward enough, but we're incredibly proud of all you've done. I'm tearing up over here. So we hope that you'll accept this Gold Creator Award as a token of our esteem. With your track record, we suspect it will only keep growing, and we can't wait to reach your next milestone, 10 million subscribers. Well, let's see about that. It may be far away, but remember, so were the days where you were psyched to have 1,000. Be amazed, keep daring, dream big. I'm out of here soon. Susan Wojcicki, or however you pronounce it. How do you pronounce her last name?
Wojcicki.
There we go.
Wojcicki, yeah. I like how it asks if you'll accept this award that you have to actually apply for to get. You know,
and then send them acknowledgement and your mailing address. Yes, I believe at that point I acknowledge that I'm willing to accept said award.
Yeah,
it segues seamlessly into Susan moving on.
There we go. So she's out now.
Does that mean anything? I don't even think it
everybody's does. Everybody's trying to attach some sort of meaning to it. But the guy who's replacing her has been working with her apparently for a long time and kind of like her right hand man. So I don't think anything's really going to change. I think it's all the same. Susan Wojcicki seemed to me like a pretty decent CEO. I mean, she certainly had Google in mind since the beginning, because she was the one she rented out her garage to Page and who was the other guy? Sergey Brin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they started out Google. And so she's been with Google since the very beginning. And then
I never knew
CEO.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. Down here in Redwood City or wherever they started, Palo Alto. She's been with them forever. And so she had kind of a real interest, I think, in Google products. Not sure about the new guy. I don't know. What's your take on the whole thing?
Like, I started thinking about it, and it's like the CEO of YouTube is like a figurehead position. It's the person who's the media savvy person who can sign these letters and whatever. But like to think that it's her vision which is driving what YouTube's going into, I guess, is maybe disingenuous. It's more of like, this is the leader who we all follow and listen to and whatnot. However, what she's saying is a combination of so many different voices and And so I don't know if like at this point a CEO of YouTube really like, oh, now the platform is going to change. I remember on the day that it was announced, people were on Twitter being like, bring back the dislike button. Like it was Susan who was like, I don't want the dislike button anymore. So again,
she's got an answer to the board, and then it's like any other company. Well, it's like the president of the United States doesn't have supreme power over everything. And the one thing about Susan Wojcicki that was good is she was fairly accessible to creators who wanted to interview her or whatever and talk to her. And whenever I saw interviews of her, she seemed pretty relatable, I think, as far as a CEO can be, and seemed to try to be involved. I know she's kind of like the person who gets all the attack. She's the face of everything that goes wrong with YouTube is kind of placed on her. But I didn't really see it that way. But I don't think we're going to be seeing the dislike button anytime soon. I think, you know what would be cool is if the CEO started a YouTube channel.
Communicated
to people. Yeah. I mean, it's the platform of, I remember for a long time, YouTube had a blog, and that was how they communicated to creators. I was like, this is the dumbest thing. You've got a video platform and you're blogging.
And that's how you literally handle support requests. And it was, oh, what a nightmare. I don't actually think that much is going to change as far as that's concerned. And to be honest, I've put YouTube in a bit of a box on a shelf for the most. It's kind of like on, it made me start thinking about like what quote unquote a channel dying means, because we're at the point where it's like we clearly see the cresting of our like surge, and we know that, you know, they come and go. We've seen enough cold periods to know that like it's sooner or later. But the mentality that we have towards our videos now are just like it's something which needs to be done, and so it becomes very easy to like just quickly do what needs to be done to kind of feed the system and like move on from it. And I'm wondering if like the channels that like quote unquote die are actually just channels which realize that you run out of momentum, because after 10 years or 5 years or whatever that period is, like there's a bunch of new to replace what you had during that growth period. And like, and it came to light because as I was reading this letter, it was like, yeah, your next milestone is 10. And we never thought that. We always knew million would be possible, and we're so happy to be at 2. And maybe one day in a way distant future, we'll get to 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever organically happens based upon what we've created previously. But it's hard to think that we would be able to create and have the resources to put so much effort in to build just like that one component, like the subscriber base of our, and that's just it. Like that's the culture of YouTube has changed from worrying about, like, at least from us, like we quite frankly don't worry about subscribers. We have the luxury of not really needing to, but more so we like, we make way more money over here. So it's,
you're right,
the resources should be spent over here. And unfortunately people, you know, come by and it's like, oh, kind of missed all the videos that you used to do. And now it seems like all you do is promote your stuff. And I'm sure you get it with the, oh, well, you talk about is your courses and your videos.
And you see this on a lot of channels though, too. I think that this is kind of a natural thing. And I've mentioned this to you before, but I kind of feel like, at this point, I've reached this stage where I feel like I've transcended YouTube in a way. I still love the platform and I still, you know, like to post on it, but I don't have that same passion that I had initially for like, this is the coolest thing I got. And I think it was just a matter of sequential discouraging things becoming more than the encouraging things that are happening to me on the platform. And that can be, you know, a number of things. All of a sudden, for whatever reason, you can't understand why, people suddenly just stop watching your videos as often and it slowly starts to go down. Even though that happens to everybody, it's a really discouraging sign when you have that. It's very selfish discouragement to see other YouTubers come in and all of a sudden just go skyrocketing, you know, past you. And you think, oh, I put in all this work over the years. But at this point, like I said, I feel like I've risen above that. I don't really care so much about working the system.
Yes. I guess because it's like that's not the easy part by any stretch of the imagination. However, it's much more difficult, like once you've reached the mountaintop, to you know, stay as high as you can for as long as possible, knowing that like every trajectory, like it's a trajectory. Like at some point you have to face that. And it was never an issue because even when we weren't putting in much work, our evergreen organic content was doing well enough to just every month get us tens of thousands of new subscribers. You understand because you have content which literally serves the same purpose. 80% of the videos that generate like the majority of our subscribers are from years and years and years ago. So you start like associating the value with that as opposed to then, like you say, you've transcended and you now understand that like as sad it is as it is that your kids have to grow up, it's best that they grow up. It's best that you've
that's kind of it.
Yeah, and that's what it was. It is bittersweet, but it's best for me not to continue to use time that I can be producing things which help me in other ways. And I get like maybe people are like, oh, it's just money, but like money to me represents now a lot of different stuff, not just acquiring money. So like that's where I want to spend my time, not again rushing. And I was texting with Kevin Espiritu about this. Like it's so nice to make content where you're not chasing, like there's no expectation of what the views need. Like the content isn't qualified by the views that it gets, and you can just kind of like it and be like, I know it, this is what needs to work in order for like me to sell some cloths and me to get people interested in buying some ebooks and and you have to swallow the people who are like, oh, all you do is talk about your stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know what to tell you. There's not much of a business model in making free YouTube videos for everyone, regardless of how many subscribers you have.
I think the thing that is always at the on our minds, whether it's in the back of our minds or at the forefront, is do I have a dead channel? Is my channel going to be a dead channel? And then I think that's a question that really isn't relevant because it's something that other people, I think, put on channels. I've done it myself. I'll look at a channel, and what do? You compare the subscriber number to the actual number of views that a video gets. And from that, we kind of extrapolate, well, it's a dead channel. When, in fact, a channel with a million subscribers that gets 20,000 views a video, 20,000 people watching a video isn't bad at all. There's nothing, there's nothing wrong with getting those kind of numbers, but we somehow put meaning on that because we know other people are looking at those numbers, I think.
And then it becomes like an elephant in the room, or it becomes like this other thing which is now involved in the whole product. It's like, man, now I need to worry about all of this too. So it's easy to get burnt out because then you're like chasing the dragon and trying to do the thing that worked.
But there's a lot of channels that just keep plodding through. Let me look at Smosh. Smosh was the biggest channel around. And then now they just keep doing it. They're not getting huge numbers, but I don't watch them anymore, but people like it. The dumb people who watch it seem to like it.
You also get more comfortable with the smaller numbers. I find the smaller numbers now for our videos way more representative of what kind of seems to be, at least with like comments and likes and engagement and like understanding how much traction a video should get and whatnot, it seems to be representing. We were talking last podcast, I think it was, about Aaron Marino, and he has like 6.5 million subscribers and he'll produce a video and he gets less than 50,000 views. It's like, is that a dead channel? I guess if you were to look at it and be like, oh yeah, look, he has this massive audience, but he can't get reach. But it's like, that's also a video which gets 50,000 views. So anybody in their right mind would want to get that kind of like reach. And the people who are watching that are the people who are still watching Aaron's content. And that's the whole point. Like, you stop with this whole, like, it needs to be growth. And you start appreciating, even if it's just like, and that moved our focus from like thinking that we needed to appease the 2 million subscribers to like, no, it probably should be more the 100,000 people that are on an email list, or these people over here who have bought stuff off of us or whatnot, and stop with everything needing to be this. No, I need to trend so I can get new subscribers and new views and fresh eyes.
Because we're still hooked on this subscription model, which everybody really knows. God, how many times have we talked about this? The subscribers really doesn't mean much of anything, but somehow we all hold meaning to that subscriber number, and so all they did was just click because they liked one video. And I still think that it would be really cool if they changed that to where you had to actually fully watch like three videos before you could subscribe to a channel.
You had to like, earn your subscription. So you would wear it as a badge of honor. Yeah, I agree. I think subscriptions are going to become kind of just like the notification bell of YouTube so that you can get alerts and like you can keep updated with the channel. And I think the memberships and the join button will become the new thing, which is the primary focus that people are trying to drive people to.
Do you remember a few weeks ago I was talking about this idea and Hank Green, somebody on his comment, they left a comment on how they liked that he was using his community tab as Twitter. Yeah. And I thought that's kind of an interesting idea, the YouTube community tab is Twitter. Well, I've been following this guy for a month now. Do you know Fredo on TV? He started on TikTok, but he reacts to TikToks. He's real funny. And so he has been using the community tab heavily and extensively. Like every day he'll post one or two posts on that thing. And they're interesting and it's fun to listen to what he has to say. And I don't know. I like that idea. I just like the idea of using this feature that nobody really seems to be using on YouTube, and yet he's getting all this engagement. Doesn't post a picture or anything, just is like talking to his audience.
I've noticed on my feed on the YouTube app, I'm getting more alternative media and polls and whatnot being promoted. Like they are promoting the community tab with it. It's not just like a scrolling list of videos and then the side scrolling list of shorts. Have you noticed a reduction in the pushing shorts to you?
Yeah, I think so. They just show up on that little shelf there on my phone. And that's sometimes I look at a couple of them if it's one of the first two ones. But I don't spend, I view them so totally differently than I would on, you know, TikTok, where you're just like boom, 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 going through them one after another. It's just, I'll look at a couple and then that's it. But I think that YouTube has really separated those out really well.
I also watched YouTube without, like, on an account that wasn't my account, so it wasn't a premium account, and I saw how many ads they have now on, like, you literally have to sit through to two full ads to watch like a 15 minute video or something along those lines. It's a lot.
I know. I can, once in a while I'll go on like incognito mode. Also, you can that turns off your account and then you can see the ads, but yeah, there's a lot of ads running.
And they repeat. And I also noticed, I remember way back in the days of AdSense on your website, and they used to be like, you can put a maximum of three ads on a page.
Yeah.
Only one can be, quote unquote, above the fold. And then the other ones had to be certain sizes and they whatever. And then you would have to have a certain amount of word count, da 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 da, if you wanted to get a fourth ad. And it was just a big thing. And they used to monitor. And if you had too many ads on you, you would get thing and they would suspend you and da da da. Have you noticed that when you go to a website now, which I guess the larger thing is no one really ever does that, there's 100 ads on every single page. Like as you scroll, they reload.
Yeah.
And sometimes either it's just me and I don't use my computer properly. But like I'll do a search for whatever, like handbags or something like that, something banal like that. And it'll be the same ad over and over and over. No, it's like, it's this weird and then some of them expand and start playing videos and like the amount of like ad just everywhere and trying to find content now is so like the scale has shifted so much and I don't know if that is it just me that's noticed that or do
no
you even...
It's going to get worse too with AI generated content online. You know, now people are ostensibly having to write these articles, but you know, now when you're searching for something and you get these websites, it is getting to the point where some sites are so frustratingly hard to navigate on a phone because you're trying to scroll and then an ad comes up, it interrupts the scroll and then it kind of like springs back and the ad keeps popping and it's unreadable to read these things. And the way that they're written is they want to keep you reading this as long as you can. And it's just this horrible writing style where they just don't get to the point and if you'd like to know more, keep reading. You don't have to tell me to keep reading in an article. It's just, those are the kind of things that annoy me, just like the TikTok computer voice does. But yeah, it's getting really difficult to navigate those kind of sites. And those are, the only time I do that is if it's on like a search result. I'm looking for something and I went, okay, I'll dive into it a little bit deeper. And then I'm like, oh shit, it's one of those types of sites. And then I back out and I have to go searching. And this is why I think Google, when they start implementing their AI, it's going to be a game changer. Everything is going to change because it's not going to be about going to websites anymore. It's going to be actually interacting and yep. getting answers.
That's why I'm going with the Google smart home products as opposed to the moved on from all of the stricken Alexa from my house. She's
And I think it'll probably start to work in the way it was always kind of sold to us, how that would work. You know, it was an actual conversation.
Yep. I mean, my search has switched since getting the Pixel phone because I realized that Google was going to be the company because I realized just how much I rely upon their infrastructure for the convenience of finding out information. And I have a great amount of trust for them because, I mean, whatever, they kind of have proven themselves in the search field and trying their best to like whatever. And I love their maps and I love to now when I go somewhere, instead of going to the thing to search for like a map to the thing and then click on that and then print that map out. Like it literally is, I just pick up my phone and use the Google Assistant to ask directions to, you know, whatever, the dance studio that we're going to. It will tell me how long it takes to get there in real time, like the traffic and da da da. It'll go through Google Maps, which is my favorite mapping thing. And I can do it all while I'm changing because I can just tell my, you know, Google Home to just like, hey, map the thing and da da da, send it to my phone. Like, that is really incredible. And I realized that it wasn't going to be Amazon when I set an alarm on one of our Amazon displays. We still had a couple lingering about because it's like, hey, we still have a smart display, so we'll use it, and it's a little speaker, and we'll put it in the workshop or something like that. So I set an alarm for it and did the alarm, and then the alarm went off, and I was like, Alexa, cancel or stop the alarm or whatever, and it stopped the alarm. And then after it stopped the alarm, it goes, hey, Chad, just a reminder, if you want to save money on your da-da-da-da, check it. And it was some, this weird, and I went over, I unplugged it, I said some words, which I won't repeat on this podcast, and she has yet to be plugged back in because I'm like, that's just line crossing. Like, you had it. And then I also read that they're divesting in the whole Alexa space. They want nothing to do with it because I'm sure they understand they'll be pounded by Google once Google
I think it will be soon where we will just be having normal conversations with the AI. And that's where it's good. Did you see, there was recently a Tom Scott video. He was last week, you know, Tom Scott with his red shirt and everything. He's been around forever.
But the secret is the red shirt.
That's the red shirt, yeah. You always have continuity in your videos there, too. But he just had a video on AI, and it was a long video for him because he usually does pretty short videos, but it was a 15-minute video of him just talking about his experience with AI and how it was like, okay, this is going to change everything. And he wanted a very specific thing done, and he thought, well, I can write some code to fix this Gmail problem he was having. So he thought, oh, I'll take it over to ChatGPT and tell it what the problem is, ask it what I wanted to do. It wrote the entire code for him, and he just had to, and he was like, holy crap, I don't have to actually write computer code now. This thing actually knows, and he could actually kind of talk to it and say, okay, well, this part wasn't exactly what I want, how can you fix that? And then the AI would find its own error, what happened and why that part wasn't working, and fix it. And so his contention is that right now we are at the beginning of this curve that is very similar to the beginning of the kind of web, I guess 2.0 you'd call it, or whatever, when he defined it as Napster. Napster came along, fired the first shots, and then from then everything changed.
Right.
You know, everything, we had access to anything we wanted. And he says what happens is that it'll be a slow, gradual incline of technology, and then suddenly it becomes accessible to everybody, not just geeks and nerds and computer people. And then it shoots up, and then everybody is just like on board with it, and everybody knows how to Google, and everybody knows how to download music and everything. And then it'll start to level off again. He says that right now we are at that very beginning of that shoot up curve with AI. That he says within, and I think he's right, in the next year or two, everything is going to change that we know about the internet.
Do you think TikTok is the closest thing to AI generated content? And do you think there'll be something that comes after TikTok, which is legit just a AI version of, like, it's just for all the people who are just like, I just like browsing and can, like, it's then just clearly an algorithm with like things and da da da. And if you can create everything, because you can create art and da da da, you just, it'll be a matter of time before you can literally create viral videos, and you can just have the most appealing, alluring, satisfying videos to watch endlessly. They are the perfect time. They're 7 seconds long, because that's the and you don't even now need a creator. And that's really funny that I bring that up, because one of the things I wanted to talk about was how TikTok has made it where all of the music, they've made it where, and Reels as well, has made it where the music choice for your content ends up dictating whether the content can do well. Like, so they're already getting to the point where it's like, here's the type of music you should use. Like, we're already getting to the point where the content creator is just doing what an AI would do anyway. So at what point does the divide between someone who can truly stand on their own and be like, you can't recreate what I do, and the saturation for all of the people who can have, you know, Instagram followings just because they're good looking or whatever, all of that's just AI. So like, no one has any more benefit of having an OnlyFans account, which gets $100,000 a month, because it's so easy just to like AI just recreate that stuff.
It. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, I think that even how-to content is probably susceptible to a lot of AI. If you need a short video on how to change a light bulb, nobody would watch that video, but yeah, that sort of thing, it would be, I'm certain very soon will an AI can generate that for you, the video. And so you really don't need a person to do it, because, and nobody's watching a person for his personality on how he, you know, changes a light bulb. It's just something you need to understand and learn how to do.
So as a creator, how do you stand out now that all of the best practices are cliche and aren't going to work anymore?
Well, I think what's going to happen is we always seem to tend to find our way in this. And I just made a video, which I think I'll be releasing today, probably, kind of about this whole topic of technology as it relates to woodworking and how it seems the CNC machines, laser cutters, all of this stuff is designed to give your woodworking perfection so that it's perfect. And it's the imperfections in our work that makes it interesting. And so, you know, there will be a time when a woodworker does not necessarily even need to walk out to their shop, because there's already the robots that will assemble your projects, sand them, cut everything out for you, basically do everything. All you need to do is create the file. So it's your idea to create the design, but eventually that part can be taken off your plate too, because you can have AI do the design. And like we were talking about before, you would probably just like maybe edit it and say, well, I don't really like this table leg, change it to a different style. It would create the design, send it to the various machines in your shop, and you would be, it would spit out a completed project. But I don't think that the goal of humans should always be perfection. Sure, I mean, I think we should strive for perfection, but it's those imperfections that seem to be what we're trying to strip every last bit of us, what makes us human. We're trying to strip that away from the things we make. And I think it's really important that we kind of keep our humanity. And I think that's why the handmade thing, whether it's a video or a clay pot or whatever, is always going to be in demand, because they aren't perfect.
It's going to be a massive switch, because we are at the point where it's like, I know many influencers who are like, yeah, I just, all my social media posts are just run through ChatGPT. And like, it's just going to become, now that you know that and you expect that, so therefore a certain type of post that sounds like an effective post is, again, it's just going to be cliche. There's going to be no way to tell, because now the playing field is level for everyone. Now everyone has the ability to make all of the things and best practices that work. So where does the creative push the boundaries? Like, do you return to, remember that channel that didn't have a name in the whole, like, is that what you, like, do you have to do something, or you take the unnecessary inventions route where you literally have to think about just things completely differently and in a much more creative sense, because it's not as easy to be like, hey guys, welcome back to my channel. Today I'm playing this game, and because that can just be creative. There's nothing unique about that. Like, so
it depends both. If people are more interested in the end product, like a how to do something quickly, they don't care about the artistic nature of it. Sure, I think AI can probably handle that just as good as a human could, and probably be a lot easier. But I think people are always going to be interested in pursuing art and pursuing and crafted things, not just that other people make, but that we make. I'm working on an article right now for my newsletter about the, and it was funny at the beginning of this where you showed your writing in your book when you were a child, and that you were writing in cursive, and how that's something that isn't taught anymore, that people within the last couple of decades just don't have the ability to write in cursive. They're not interested in that because there's really no need to. And a lot of people are really upset with these kind of passing things that happen like that. And you're like, oh, but I think a lot of it is just like, well, damn it, I had to learn how to do that shit. You have to learn how to do it too, because nobody needs to write cursive, and it's always horrible. So we used to have, when I was a kid, it was a category on our report cards called penmanship. So we were literally graded on how our fine motor skills, on how well we could create letters. And there were some kids who just sucked at it. They were horrible. And I think it was the more artistic kids that were able to make the loopy letters and do all that. So there's no reason really to print. When's the last time you ever needed to write something by hand, other than maybe a jot down a note to yourself? There's no need to learn these skills. But at the same time, a lot of people are finding the art of writing. And these are people who are artistic, and they're doing beautiful work in calligraphy. So all of this stuff is not going to die. There will still be people doing this stuff, I think. And I think it'll still be relevant and meaningful to a lot of people. I think that it's just going to be an additional thing that we all know that there's the AI generated stuff, but there's also the human generated stuff. That's my more optimistic take on the matter.
That's me turning to your optimistic point of view is because I must admit I put so much thought into it, because it's an intimidating subject for someone who is kind of creative in the way that I'm creative and artistic in the way that I'm, like, and I just love doing things. I sometimes like doing things just so I can destroy them, because then it intentionally can't be replicated or whatnot. Or the thing I love about painting, and literally like painting on a canvas, is like, you can't replicate. No one will be able to literally replicate what I am doing here. And as soon as you do art digitally, it can very easily be, because it really just comes down to numbers and all of the rest. And I'm just worried that it's starting to feel like this mentality is more of like an antiquated old man thing. And it's just like, I'm gonna be the guy who's like, oh, the kids these days don't know how to write. And I get the whole like, yeah, but we don't use it anymore. To your point, what you just said, it's like, it wasn't just necessarily knowing how to write, it's hand-eye coordination, it's like, it's like, there's so many other aspects of like knowing that, which is good. And the same thing happened with spelling. Remember when it was just like, yeah, we don't care about spelling anymore, just get with it. And it just seemed like this weird, like, this kind of seems like everybody's just saying this and they want to believe that that's the case, but
spelling should probably, I should probably receive an email from a potential employee or like someone who wants to sell me something. I should expect it to be spelled correctly. I should be able to judge someone for not knowing how to spell. So, and we kind of fell into that trap of like, yeah, but now we text, so it doesn't matter. And we short form everything. And that's just the way it is. It got added to the dictionary. Old man, get out of here with your old man thoughts.
There will always be people pursuing everything the old ways. There's people doing photography on film now. You know, there's all of these things are always, you know what leads technology? You know what leads technology? Porn.
Oh, it's true. Find out
if
where
there's going to be advancements in any technology. It's always led by porn.
It's true. Watch it. Yeah, AI. VR. You know what? Mark Zuckerberg has the right. Like everybody's making fun of him for the VR and the metaverse and stuff like that. You just wait. Like you said, everything's strange and whatever. But you just wait when you're a 68-year-old person who can't get on a plane anymore, who would have the ability to put on a headset and feel like they're walking through their childhood, you know, city and stuff like that, and just being able to like whatever, like you start to get why that's interesting, but like it, I don't know, it's scary because it's not real. It's not real, Steve.
I think it's normal for people to always fear new things to a certain extent. It doesn't have to be technology. Just kind of, it's an instinct. I think it's a survival instinct that if something is new, there's a new animal coming up to the cave, you're going to fear it because it's your way of being cautious. And I think that's normal for people to do that. And I think it's normal to kind of, when we see new technology, because we also have years of training about what sci-fi has taught us about how technology is always going to like destroy everything and take over. And I don't see it completely that way. I think it's just going to be one of these things we all kind of adapt to. It just becomes part of our lives. I can't imagine today not having the internet, and yet I lived, you know, half my life without the internet really, and seemed to get along fine. So,
well, just to make sure we have all of our bases covered in the future, just in case like in 10 years things change, I just wanted to end this podcast by thanking our robot overlords for their for their patience and kindness, and we salute you.